Hello, I'm Jordan Farley, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Our illustrious editor, Matt Matem, is taking a well-deserved holiday this week, so today I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hi, James. On a bumper episode for new releases, we'll be hearing from the director and stars of twisty thriller Trap, M. Night Shyamalan, Salika, and Josh Hartnett, Borderlands stars Ariana Greenblatt and Florian Muntinu, and the stars of The Instigators, Matt Damon, Casey Affleck, and Hong Chau. Plus, James and I will be reviewing all those films, as well as Blake Lively romantic drama It Ends With Us, acclaimed indie Sky Peels, pregnancy comedy Babes, and the transformative ultimate cut of 1979's notorious Caligula. But before we get into that, have you been watching anything else this week, James?
Believe it or not, I revisited Taika Waititi's Hunt for the Wilder People just because, you know, and it's such a lovely film. And it was just as lovely as I remembered it. If anyone doesn't know the little Ricky Baker song, you have to watch it, basically. So, yes, that has been my little highlight of the week. What about yourself?
It wasn't the fact that Time Bandits is on Apple TV Plus that inspired you to revisit, was it?
That it wasn't, but that's a good shout. I haven't actually watched that yet. Have you caught that one?
Yeah, we spoke about it on the pod a couple of weeks back. And yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's very Waititian, if that is now an acceptable verb. But, you know, very much in the vein of the original film as well. I mean, I've still only seen those first two episodes, so I'm intrigued to see more. I would like to see what they do with the rest of the show. Yeah, what I've been watching is the season finale of House of the Dragon, which came to a close this week. The slightly controversial season finale. Don't want to get into too many spoilers in case people haven't caught up on it yet, but I'd say that a lot of people were left a little unsatisfied by the finale because, as widely reported, this was a season that was affected by the strike last year. Of course, they sort of kept filming through the strike, so that led to some difficulties as well. And it doesn't entirely deliver on the promise of a show about big dragons fighting each other, let's put it that way. But the season as a whole, I thought, was excellent and is getting very close to peak Game of Thrones quality levels now. So I'm very excited to see where they take the show in the final two seasons, which they've announced will wrap up the story that George R.R. Martin wrote. Yeah, slightly slow going, but there's some very good stuff in there. Have you been watching?
I've seen it. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Matt Smith does come out with the immortal line, "Winter is coming." I mean, you know, if nothing else, that's some Game of Thrones fan service right there. Did you dig the, if we can't get into too many spoilers, but his vision that he has in that final episode?
His vision was cool. I do like the whole element of prophecy in the Game of Thrones world and people just stepping into their destiny and all that kind of thing. It gives it just a grander scale, doesn't it? Rather than just a bit of bickering and infighting between families, even if those families are armed with living nuclear weapons, basically. Yeah, all that stuff like makes it just feel insanely epic. So yeah, I did really, really enjoy the season as a whole, even if the finale didn't entirely deliver on what I might have expected from the finale of a series like that.
Only another 2 years to wait before winter really does start coming.
Just a short 2 years, no problem at all. So on to this week's new releases. First up, M. Night is ready to spring his latest trap.
What's with all the police everywhere? I'm not supposed to tell. You know the butcher? The freaking nut job that goes around chopping people up? The feds heard that he's gonna be here today. So they set up a trap for him. This whole concert, it's a trap.
That is Trap from M. Night Shyamalan, his first original thriller since 2016's Split. If you've seen the trailer, you'll know this one has a literally killer high concept. Josh Hartnett stars as Cooper, a father who takes his daughter to a pop concert, but it turns out that the entire event is a sting operation set up by the FBI to catch a serial killer known as the Butcher. The twist? Daddy of the Year Cooper is the Butcher. Oh my God. The film is something of a family affair for Shyamalan, with his singer-songwriter daughter Salika appearing on screen as Lady Raven and providing diegetic music for the film, Purple Rain style. Before we review the film, we're going to hear from several of the people involved, the film's writer-director M. Night Shyamalan, followed by Josh Hartnett and Salika. Bradley Russell caught up with them recently, and here's what they had to say.
He's realised he can't get out. He's going to try to cause chaos.
Dad, what are you doing? You're acting weird.
This dude is next level insane.
Let them go. Josh, the character of Cooper must have been like just an incredible role to dig into. Those initial conversations with M. Night, what sort of stuck out to you and like immediately appealed to you about that character?
What appealed to me initially was working with Night. And then beyond that, that first conversation was really about tonality. How did he want the character to come across? What did he want the film to feel like? And when I understood that kind of the assignment was to make the most fun character imaginable, as bold a kind of character as possible, I was extremely excited because I knew it would be an incredible challenge, but I also knew that, like, if we got it right, it would be totally a film that no one's seen before. So, and hopefully a character that no one's seen before.
And Trap sort of hinges on that dad-daughter dynamic. How would you describe the relationship between Cooper and Riley?
I think it's very complex. I think that he has constructed this identity to cover who he really is. So a lot of it is facade, but that facade has started to leak into his real life, and he discovers over the course of the film that maybe there's something real there, which you don't often find a movie that's from a serial killer perspective where the serial killer is learning that they're not entirely horrible. But this one is, it's unique. This film is unique. Yeah. And I think the dad-daughter relationship is the thing that kind of sets it off in motion, sets the whole thing in motion.
And Ariel Donahue, who plays Riley, brings like such a lightness and innocence to this film. How does her performance sort of bounce off and affect what you did?
It affected everything at the beginning because she's such a talent, but she's also such an effervescent personality. And when you're working with someone who has, you know, she's young. She's 13 years old when we film this. When you want to make it as fun for them as possible on set because it's long. The days are long. My family came out to visit, and her family and my family. We all hung out. We went to the zoo together. We got to know each other. But then ultimately on set, it just came down to her being a true professional. Kids on set, they also have to go to school, so they have to work twice as hard. And she was able to do the whole thing and still come in with a smile on her face and enjoy the ride. And the other thing I think that helped was that all the dark stuff in this film is kind of away from her character. Yep. So when we're at the concert, it's basically like a dad and a daughter at a concert, and we got to play that particular dad and daughter combo, and there wasn't much else for her to explore there.
Cooper is like such, for me, was like such a delicate balance for you to strike. Like, you obviously have, he's a doting dad, but also there's something like sinister underneath. Yeah. I guess, like, how much of his humanity and his love did you want to show?
I wanted him to be a really good actor because I think that if you're someone, from my research, what I could tell, these serial killers or just people who are psychopaths generally are very good at constructing an identity that doesn't let people know what's going on underneath. So, and what's fun about this movie is that you have that strong identity that's forward-facing toward the community. He's a really good dad, obviously. He seems like a really good dad. He seems like a really good husband. Nice little family home in the suburbs. And he's a fireman and pillar of the community. All of that is there to kind of deflect suspicion. He plays the role well. So I wanted that to be front and center. And then the cracks, when they start to form over the course of the day, there are two elements to it. The first one is that he's thrilled because he's the center of attention and he's a narcissist. And the second one is he doesn't want anybody to actually find him in this situation because he doesn't want his daughter to find out. And then he starts to realize, oh, why is it that I don't want my daughter to find out? Oh, I think I might actually like her. I think there's something there that I don't really understand because he's never really understood love the way that you and I would.
And you mentioned that research. Were there any sort of like real world examples or figures you looked towards to sort of understand why these figures are so disarming, they're so charismatic, they appeal to certain people?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at specific cases. I didn't want to emulate anyone in particular. I wanted it to be completely Cooper because Knight wrote such an interesting role. I think it would be a disservice to kind of take, you know, like we want to do this like Ted Bundy or something like that. It has to be Cooper. And so we discussed at length like what it is that makes Cooper who he is, but also it had to be in line. And both of us did a ton of research on psychopathy. And then beyond that, on serial killers. And the good thing is about this research is that serial killers love to talk about themselves. So when they get caught, they want to give you all the information. So it's all there. You can just read it, like why they did it, how they did it, what the whole thing was. Not the most fun read, but it is something that gave a lot of insight into who this character could be. And also knowing that, like, I read this book called The Psychopath Test, and there's over 4% of us that kind of could be put in that psychopath category, and 10% of us that have sociopathic tendencies. And you can see these people all over in our society on TV and whatnot. So you get a sense of who these people could be. And yeah, the charm is there in a lot of it.
And in Trap, Cooper is like obsessed with details. It really sort of makes him sell his different roles that he sort of takes on in the film. which is, I think, in a way, is like similar to an actor like making an audience buy in. So I wanted to ask, like, what was one detail of your character that you worked on obsessively to get right to really sell the authenticity?
I think the thing that I was most interested in was the, and this is, I think, a symptom of the way I usually work as an actor, is that I really want to get the psychology right. And the physical stuff, there was a notion in the script that was repeated many times that he's a big guy. He's very strong. And I wanted him to look very out of place in this sea of young people at this concert. And so the big jacket, the fact I gained some weight and muscle, I tried to put on as much muscle as possible. Tried to make him simultaneously intimidating and sort of like awkwardly out of place. And then I wanted to kind of make the dad-daughter relationship almost a little stilted, like he's almost too good a dad, or when he's relating to her, he's almost too intensely relating to her. Kind of little tells that people would be able to kind of, you know, see when they watch it a second time or whatever. The meticulous nature was important to me too. Things that would give him away that he might be okay with, like the watch was a very expensive watch. He's always giving this jewelry to his wife and daughter. He's just like, there are things about him. He's wearing these kind of ridiculously big boots. Clearly he's up to something. He doesn't seem like just a normal dad. But yeah, I think those are the things I was most focused on.
And I believe Trap was filmed almost as if it was a real concert. So like, yeah. How unique of an experience was that for you as an actor?
Totally unique. I've never been involved in a film that has this sort of this scope to it in that sense. We had thousands of extras there for every one of these performances from Salika. And it would be like day after day, she would do one song each day. The extras would be given the song beforehand so they would know what they were coming for. And a lot of them became, most of them actually became huge fans of Salika, because what she pulled off here is kind of magnificent. She's not a pop singer usually. And she created a very poppy, very earwiggy, you know, exciting album. And all of these songs have something to do with my character. So I think it's probably the only pop soundtrack from a serial killer perspective album ever created. And it's remarkable. And so the audience would come in and they would have a natural reaction to Salika going up there and performing it. And then Knight would capture that. He would do the first takes on the audience, and then he would turn around and shoot Salika. And it was really cool to be a part of.
I could be wrong, but I believe the film was filmed chronologically or as close to it as possible. Like, yeah. Which obviously isn't always the case in these sorts of films. What does that do to your performance? Was there something that you maybe looked back on in like an earlier scene that you sort of maybe adjusted on the fly or changed a little bit? Or was there anything?
I think it allowed us to be bold in the characterization and know that we could make all of that sort of tie in at the end. I think we would have been bold nonetheless if we were shooting out of order, but I think it allowed us the sort of like space to breathe, being like, okay, if that felt a little bit too much, that's okay, because it makes sense if we do this here. I think it's just a wonderful way to work if you can. It's not the usual way to work because it's more expensive and you need somebody like Knight, who's so meticulous in his planning, to make it happen. Not every director is that way.
And you worked with M. Night, and of course you worked with Christopher Nolan on Oppenheimer. Yeah. I'm just curious to know, like, in terms of their two styles, like, how opposite, like, or different are they? Or
what's great about Night and what's great about Chris, there are two things that I think make them very similar, is that they're both very meticulous about the way they go about things, but they're also both incredibly collaborative. When a director is at the top of their game, the way that Chris and Night are, they don't feel the need to guard their creation with everything they have from their collaborators, because they trust the people that they've hired to be a part of it. And ultimately, their vision is so clear that it can contain a lot of different perspectives without being threatening to them. Whereas some other directors who are a little bit less sure-footed will guard everything and not allow you an opinion. So I love the collaborative nature of it. And Knight, I think, is singularly warm on set, the opposite of the scripts that he writes. Like, he's just very, very warm. And he wants to create a family atmosphere so that you feel that kind of comfortability exploring the character.
M. Night films have like such a fascinating relationship with their audience, where like I feel like people try and like, maybe second guess or try and figure out what's coming. So for those who have seen the trailer and they think they know what's coming next, what would you say to that?
I would say that Night's films are always surprising, so don't get too comfortable. But, you know, I invite all the fan theories. I think it's hilarious. But I think when they go and actually watch the film, they're going to be taken in by a different ride than they expect.
In Trap, like, you've got this idea, the serial killer manhunt pop concert. Like, where did that idea come from?
I mean, there's a lot of sources of how we got here, but you know, the general feeling was trying to make a movie where the music was really dominant in the movie and was part of the character of the film. And Salik and I talked about, you know, is there a way to make a film where we can combine our two art forms in a real significant way, not a kind of a score, but as actually part of the plot. And so let me think of a thriller, then you can write an album for it. And it was meant for somebody else, but then as I started to write it, the fun of it all made it feel like this is something I'd love to direct myself.
And Josh Hartnett plays Cooper. Why was he the perfect fit for this role, and sort of like what extra elements did he add on top of your script? Because like it's a role where you have to sort of balance the sympathy of being a father, but then as you've seen in the trailers, there's also the sort of sinister element underneath.
Yeah, I loved how you said that. What does he add to the script? I think when you cast someone, they're leaning the screenplay one way or the other, or they're bringing out colors or suppressing colors in what you wrote based on their comfort zone. And Josh Hartnett has a big, wide comfort zone. So he's a very courageous actor. So, you know, all the colors in the script, he just kept bringing them up and celebrating them. And primarily kind of the wit and the humor of the piece, he just went for it every time. And it kind of, you know, to the point that, you know, the crew, the cast, everybody was just laughing constantly because of his take on the kind of darkness.
And Ariel Donahue, who plays Riley, you know, she brings such an earnestness and like an innocence to the film. But even you must have been surprised. You've worked with so many young actors in your career, but even you must have been surprised by like the heart she brings to this.
Yeah, when she auditioned, it was one of those kind of moments that I've been super lucky to have in my life many times, but it's still a miracle every time it happens. You know, kids auditioning from all around the world for me. The auditions are being sent from every country, and then this little girl from Australia auditions, and she's just perfect. And then I go, okay, I'm going to Zoom with her. Please, you know, make sure this is real. And then I make sure her family's good, and then I Zoomed with her, auditioned with her again, talked with her family. They're all so lovely, and I'm like, oh, I can't believe it. Because, you know, in many ways, you know, if she's not working, the movie isn't working, because you have to love this father-daughter. You have to root for them, and that she is part of the reason you're rooting for him.
And you mentioned your daughter, Salika, who plays the pop star Lady Raven in this, and I feel like maybe some people will ask you, what does maybe a father impart onto their child in terms of knowledge? But I kind of want to flip that. What did you learn from her in terms of her skill set and experiences as a singer for this film?
It's so great that you asked it that way, because a lot of people are thinking, you know, that it's primarily a father-daughter mentor-mentee relationship, but that wasn't the case on Trap. It was very much two artists working with each other that respect each other deeply. You know, for me, Salika is, you know, an unbelievable talent in music, just world class. So in many ways, she's reteaching me the things that maybe I taught her when I was a kid, you know, when she was a kid. And it's kind of in the way her standards for herself and how just hard she is on herself. And she goes in, and when she comes and shows me a song, it's just, and by that point she's gone through many, many, many iterations. Her standard for herself is so high. She's so courageous. And I think she's reminding me, I think as we get older, especially in this movie 16, as you can see, I'm trying not to be safe. I'm trying to keep on doing things that are way out of my comfort zone, stuff that you guys haven't seen before, you haven't asked for. You've never asked for these colors. No one knows whether these are going to work. And that's where I want to live, because that's where you are when you're starting out. And Salika's there, and she's capable of doing anything, and she reminds me of that.
And you mentioned the songs. I believe Salika wrote 14 songs or an entire album for this. So, like, what does that sort of personal contribution do to elevate both her character and elevate the movie?
Again, I think you've kind of phrased it in a way that's really powerful, that her contribution being so personal, that when you're watching in the background, you know, you're seeing this picture of her behind us, right? Her singing with the crowd. But you're hearing, wow, there's a real artist there who's singing words that she believes in, and that resonance is hitting the kids and hitting the audience. And so behind Josh and over his shoulder is a real event that's happening, an artistic, powerful event that he's a part of. And that just gives the movie such depth, you know, and it's such a buoyant, fun movie to ride, but that depth of music grounds it in this really unusual way, and I believe will cause it to have resonance over time.
Alongside Salika, like, what were other pop stars that you sort of either gravitated towards or maybe even reached out to sort of when shaping that role of Lady Raven?
You know, I think artistically, you'd have to ask Salika this one, but artistically, I think Rosalia was a really interesting signpost for her. in terms, and for us in terms of her choreography and her integrity and her emotion when she performs. And we both Sleek and I love her, you know. And then I looked to kind of the big icon pop stars and how they interrelate with their audiences, like Taylor and Justin, and why they have such rabid fan bases, and how did they navigate that in a concert setting.
You mentioned the concert, that just sort of came to mind. Like, I think you did film this movie essentially as a concert in places. Mm-hmm. What were some of the biggest challenges in terms of logistics, in terms of balancing all that for you as a director? Because like you said, this isn't safe, this is very different.
Yeah, I mean, we made the decision, or I made the decision to do it live. So Josh is performing and says his, you know, dialogue, and there's a real concert going on. Okay. And so the lighting, the performance, the crowd, they're all genuinely reacting to what's happening. So and it's tied. So that moment, that part of the song, the way Salika sang it, the way the crowd's reacting, the way the dancers are moving, with where he said the line, it's married together. So the lighting and the movement is all hitting him in that way. And I think that makes it very real, as opposed to, hey, we'll put it in later, and then you'd slightly feel it's not real. That yeah. you wouldn't even know why that uncanny valley was there, but you go, this isn't real. And it's just not alive, you know? I shoot on film because I want it to feel alive and real and messy in that human way.
I love the details of the concert. Like, it's almost like you had the pilgrimage through the concourse, maybe getting to your seat a little bit early to see the opener. Mm-hmm. What were some of the details you were most proud of? And, like, what did you really work at to get right, to make it feel authentic?
The idea of the ritual of a concert as the structure of the movie was really interesting to me. I love rituals. You know, human beings are drawn to rituals, you know? And so the kind of, what does it feel like to drive to the concert with your dad? What does it feel like to try to get a glimpse of them back before they even arrive at the venue? And then what is it like waiting in line? You're just about to enter the place. Each of those steps, grab some food with your parent right before you get to your seat. Then you get to your seat, and oh my gosh, this is our seat. And the lights are all on. It's a very different feeling. And then the opener comes on, and the lights are still on, but you're pumped. You're getting one step closer to your hero. All of those steps are so fun, and to walk it with this little girl and her dad was a joy to write. I think it's part of why it wrote so fast.
Trap feels like, I guess, like one of the more outwardly contemporary of your films, just because we seem to be living in sort of a golden age of like pop stars and stadium tours right now. What's so intriguing and maybe like a little bit sinister on pulling on that pop culture thread just a little bit?
I find when you do something kind of dark against something very fun and light, it can enhance the darkness, you know? I mean, the classic examples would be like The Omen, Birthday Party, and then, you know, the nanny's like, this is for you, Damien. You know, it's much worse that it's happening at a birthday party, you know? So you have that. But in this movie, the fact that he kind of enjoys the game, the cat and mouse, he kind of loves it, you know? These guys, they don't feel anything. And so they keep getting drawn to, how close can I get to getting caught, you know? And so part of this is that he's trapped, but he kind of loves it. Yeah. And so there's a fun playfulness. So he's dancing his way as he's figuring this out.
The Sixth Sense turns 25 literally next week. Sort of a look back at that, like recalling, what were some of your fondest memories from that opening weekend where it looks like, you know, all of a sudden you have like this major hit on your hands, which seems like comes out of left field a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I remember in those days, you used to call a phone number. You dial a phone number as a filmmaker, literally. You know, you dial a phone number and you would hear a recording where it would tell you what each movie grossed. That's what everybody did. You called a phone number and it would go, today's grosses are, and then when they said the Friday grosses, it was like, what? As we were getting closer, it looked like it was gonna do okay, you know? And then when it did the Friday gross, I was like, huh. And I called Bruce or Bruce called me and said, wow, we won Friday. That's so weird, because no one thought we were gonna do that. My memory was, I could be totally wrong, that we did $8 million on that Friday, which for us, we were like, what? That was so crazy. I remember going, huh, that's really weird. And then I'd have another memory, which wasn't the opening weekend, it was the second weekend. So I called the same number again, right? You call the same number to find out the gross. And I called the same number and it said 8 million. And I was like, they didn't redo the tape, not realizing that it didn't drop. That hasn't happened since Titanic. So that was really weird. I was like, oh, they don't have the new grosses up yet. It's the same grosses from last week. Literally, I went around and told the family, I guess they have to put the tape. And then I called back, still 8. And I was like, what is this? And then someone called me and said, you dropped 1% or something like that.
What sparked the idea of working with your father and bringing in your music as that sort of like creative synergy?
Yeah, I mean, it was an idea that we had been talking about for a while. I didn't know how it would manifest, but we wanted to bring music and film together. And I kind of, you know, we started off with, I wrote one song for Old, and then I wrote an EP of songs for Servant. And then we really were feeling like we could do this in, you know, a long-form narrative as a film and kind of integrate the music in a very special way that, you know, is connected to the characters and connected to the plot. So it was something we talked about for a while.
You play Lady Raven, this like huge pop star. How did you sort of create that persona? What was like the starting point for that character?
I mean, the starting point was definitely the music, I would say, and just sort of establishing what does this concert feel like. And we did a lot of that work prior to, you know, getting even into pre-production. And, you know, writing the album for me really let me kind of define who this person is through the music. So that was very fun. And I think, you know, the character is very confident and bold and all of these things, and my dad wrote her in that way on the page, and so it was kind of bringing the music in, making something that felt connected to the person that he wrote.
I found it really interesting in the film. We see Lady Raven the performer, but we also see like Lady Raven the person, like backstage. Yeah. What sort of aspects of her personality did you want to heighten or maybe even remove from her onstage persona versus what we see backstage?
I think it was actually very important to us that it felt consistent. We wanted, you know, there are some artists that I think put on a persona on stage that's different than off stage, but we wanted, for kind of the message of the film, that it was important that this person, Lady Raven, is very consistent with who she is on stage and who she is off stage. And that's part of her value system, is that, you know, she's truthful and she's showing who she really is to her fans. And I think that was very important kind of in the rest of the movie, as you get to know kind of what happens.
And you mentioned you wrote an album, I believe, of 14 songs. Why was that so important for you to go all the way with that, like such a extensive, exhaustive project?
Yeah, I mean, my dad wrote a script with 14 songs needed for it, so I had to write 14 songs. I mean, he originally in the script, there was actually 19 songs. Okay. And then as he was editing it, it became 14. And, you know, one, it's just to establish, you want it to feel like you've watched an entire concert. And so even though you don't hear all the songs fully, the movement of the music from the opening to the middle, and you're suddenly in the middle of the concert, what does that feel like? And then you're at the end, and then there's a feature, kind of needing to have all that diversity in there to feel like you've experienced an immersive and complete concert, I think was essential to the movie.
And as you sort of listen to the songs in the movie, you sort of see maybe they have like messages for like what's going on like in the scene. What do you think these songs add to the film, add to your character? Mm-hmm. Like for me, it sort of added like an authenticity. I felt like a history, like you felt like an actual, you know, like an actual performer.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the authenticity and kind of detail to the backstory was very important. I think in writing the songs for me, I like to connect the lyrics to everything that's happening. I don't think like it wasn't necessarily mandatory for every single song, but for me, I feel like it really integrates with the plot and when it connects to what the audience is feeling. And it's interesting is in this movie, you're with Cooper's character, you're with this villain kind of character, and you're thinking from his perspective. And so the songs not only have to function through Lady Raven's voice and feel like a pop concert, but they also have to tell sort of at least match kind of where he is at with his mindset as this plot goes on.
I mean, was there a favorite song you had or something you really clung to during production?
I mean, the ballads, I think, were very special to me. There's one in the concert called Release, and then there's one near the end of the movie called Where Did She Go? Those were definitely some of the most challenging to write just because they had to be very specific, especially lyrically, but became the most rewarding because of that, I think, and very special to me. And I still, you know, feel very emotional and connected to them.
Like the last actor I spoke to who wrote music specifically for a movie was Florence Pugh last year for A Good Person. Mm-hmm. And she said like it was very much the script that inspired her to sit down and write. Obviously, it's a little bit different here, but like, could you point to something in the script that maybe influenced you or inspired you in a certain way?
I mean, I would say it was the same for me. I think, you know, I started writing once the script was done and took everything from the script in terms of like themes to talk about, I would say, you know, kind of feeling the overall like undercurrents of what the movie is about. I think it's like connection to people and then also hiding from people and dissociating and not showing who you are versus, you know, Lady Raven, who feels like everybody knows her in a way. So the sort of universality and those concepts, I think we can all relate to, or at least I relate to them. And there's aspects of both of those things, I think, in all of us, things we feel connected to humanity and things where we hide ourselves. And so that was sort of an undercurrent for a lot of the songs in terms of thinking about themes. I think there's also, you know, really interesting darkness and kind of villain mindset and what it feels like to be, you know, the anti-hero or kind of that, the fun of that and the mischievousness of that, the cat and mouse. So there was a lot of, you know, all of that really inspired me.
And I believe Trap was almost filmed as a concert, essentially like a real live concert. So, like, what was the biggest challenge for you in terms of juggling all of that?
It was a lot. I think I definitely felt overwhelmed at the beginning of the process and, like, how am I going to balance all these things? But in some way, it was like an art boot camp because I was writing all these songs and we were doing, you know, dance lessons, choreography, rehearsals. I was doing costume fittings, trying to figure out what costume goes where. We were doing stage design, you know, and then acting rehearsals as well. So it was like all of these things together. But in a way, kind of going between all of the art forms ended up complementing each other. And like as I was doing dance rehearsals, I was getting inspired by seeing the dancers' movements, and it made me write differently. It made me go back and I was like, oh, I have this idea, seeing how they were dancing to this beat. I was like, I think I have this idea for this hook. So it all fed each other, which was amazing.
I kind of want to go back as well to like working with your father. Like, what was the like song you were most proud of with that collaboration, whether it was like a creative choice or no, or just even simply just working together?
I mean, he really, you know, gave me my creative freedom in terms of like writing, and he, you know, he wasn't really in the studio with me. It was more so me presenting him with songs and then him being like yes or no kind of thing. Those two ballads, I would say, were kind of special moments in terms of I know that he had a specific vision for what he wanted that was really laid out in the script that didn't exist. And so I had to kind of create what he was imagining, and I wanted it to be what he wanted, you know. So it's like some of the other ones, it's more sort of complementing the scenes, and those really had to fill a role. And so it was like, did I write the right song that he is, you know, imagining in his head? And so those were really nerve-wracking, but I think felt very rewarding when they connected with him.
I think I'm right in saying this is your first major acting role. So like, how do the nerves compare to like, say, opening a concert or starting a gig to like the first take on set?
You know what's really funny is I have much more anxiety on stage performing than acting. I was like trying to analyze myself and understand why that is, but I do have extreme stage fright. But I think on set, in some ways, it's like my comfort zone. Like it feels like the studio in a way where you do have to be raw and vulnerable, but you're also protected and you're creating something with a group of people. Sometimes when you go out on stage, like at least for me, I feel very alone. I feel like I want to do right by the audience and there's like pressure and I'm scared. And on set, it's like this incredible collaborative experience and you're not alone and you're trying to capture something together with other people, and it's very exciting and rewarding when that happens. You know, in this industry, you can never take anything for granted, and so I feel, you know, just grateful to have done this project, and if it's all the acting I ever do, I'm incredibly grateful for that. I'll always be writing music, but, you know, I'd love to keep writing music for TV and film, and, you know, we'll see where that takes me.
And M. Night's films, like, they never ever do the same thing twice, which I think is, like, just, yeah, the joy of it. But, like, I assume you've also been around your father's sets all your life, so, like, what felt different about this one?
It was great to have that experience, kind of watching him through my life. At least I came into it with an understanding of how the sets work and how all the processes work. So I did feel comfortable, but kind of getting, usually I'm, you know, my family and I are watching kind of from the side and observing, you know, this like picturesque view, but kind of being in it and being there at 4 a.m. in the morning and with the crew and all that stuff, it's a totally different experience. And you feel the highs and lows with everybody and the stress with everybody. But I did feel like I got a deeper understanding of how my dad works and a deeper appreciation for him, kind of experiencing him through the perspective of the crew and seeing, you know, their experiences on other sets and things and feeling, you know, the familial feeling of what it's like to be on one of his sets.
And not to spoil anything, but you do share scenes with Josh Hartnett's Cooper, who he's fantastic in this. What did you sort of learn from him, and what did he bring out from you, like, during those filming those scenes?
I mean, I think he's incredibly truthful and incredibly free and spontaneous, which I think, you know, my dad is as well in terms of his style of directing. Watching him work was obviously incredible. He's so good at what he does, and it was even just watching him work and, you know, with Ari as well, you know, they're so fun and they're so dynamic. And he brings this buoyancy to the role, which is unexpected in a way. You're thinking such a dark character, how to bring buoyancy to that. And he kind of blends these two, the charming and the scary, together in this like perfect way that you don't think could exist. And so it was amazing to watch him work.
That was M. Night Shyamalan, Josh Hartnett and Salika speaking to Bradley Russell. Now, James and I haven't actually seen Trap because the distributor, Warner Brothers, chose not to show the film to critics. Read into that what you will. So we've parachuted in our interviewer, Bradley, who has seen the film, to give us his thoughts. So Bradley, what did you think?
As ever with M. Night Shyamalan films, there's always so much to talk about. And like, I always find that he's the master of just this killer idea that's going to get you seated opening day no matter what. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it described as like American Psycho Taylor's version, which I thought was fantastic. That's sort of like the twist of the serial killer, the light and the dark of the pop star. If you haven't seen the trailers yet, I would really advise not seeing it, because I know people go into M. Night Shyamalan movies all the time and they expect the twist. But with this, I'd say it's perhaps a little bit more of a straightforward thriller, which is interesting to me. Maybe doesn't quite have the pull the rug out from you moment that you're expecting, which it could work against you, but you still might enjoy it as just a pretty by-the-numbers thriller. For me, it was, I'd say, a five-star idea wrapped up in a three-star movie. I love the big swings M. Night takes with it. Like, for me, he's like a credit to the industry. Like, the industry would be a lot worse off without filmmakers who make the big creative choices that he does in this movie. Mm. It all, for me, boils down to his ethos, which is always putting interesting people in interesting situations. And that drives, like, the first hour of the movie. It's sort of when it veers away from that core conceit that it loses momentum slightly, for me. Obviously, I won't get into spoiler territory, but you do have that core conceit of the concert. And it sort of just floats away. The suspension just sort of melts away as you get nearer and nearer the end. And like the final act in particular does feel like it drags his feet a little bit long in the tooth for about 20 minutes. And it's not a long movie, but there is a sort of slight issue with the rhythm and the pacing there.
How is Salika in that role?
Yeah, that's super interesting, because it is her first major acting role, and she's an incredible performer. You might hear in the interview that she wrote like 14 songs specifically for this film. They're going on as scenes progress. She's a fantastic performer, but like, she sometimes gets a little bit of the deer in the headlights for me, in terms she seems a little bit uncomfortable in front of the camera in terms of the big emotional scenes, which is fine. Like, that comes with the territory. Like, if it's your first time on camera and in a big acting role, like, she will develop, and like all the signs are there that she has the potential to be like someone who can be a great actor. But yeah, they're just, it's definitely not a bad performance. Like, it almost kind of feeds into that uncanny valley that M. Night's trying to create in this film. Like, there is a pop star who's taken very much out of her comfort zone, out of her familiar territory, and I think she does work with that quite well. The song, singer-songwriter side of it was definitely her strong point, I felt.
Do you think this could continue the small Josh Hartnett renaissance we're sort of in the middle of at the moment?
100%. Like, for me, this is like one of my favourite performances of him. M. Night just allows him to go big and goofy and kind of almost like a little bit weird with it, which is great.
Right.
Like, part of his role as Cooper is he takes on other roles of people. Like, he's almost like a chameleon in that respect. You'll see, like, he's very nuanced with his body language, with his like mannerisms, as he sort of creeps around this concert hall, around the concourses. He really plays big with it, and like he just gets that balance right of like, he's a believable doting dad. I think he's mentioned on several occasions like his experience as a father of daughters sort of played into that role, but like, he could believably kill you with his bare hands, you know, like he's a sort of weird gentle giant, but like there's something really sinister bubbling up underneath, and he plays with it so well. And he's, like I say, he's not scared to get like play to the back seats with it, which I really like in performances like that.
Yeah, that's terrific. On one level, even though, you know, it doesn't sound like it's a total return to form for Knight, I'm just really glad he's out there making original thrillers like this, because no one else is doing it like at this scale, essentially. You just don't see these films getting released in cinemas anymore, certainly not original thrillers. And yeah, even if it's not, you know, his very best work, like, I'm just really glad it's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a film like you absolutely have to see, like, even if you think it's a five star, if you think it's a one star, like, and the best thing about M. Night is like, feasibly, you could understand if anyone came out of that thinking it'd be any sort of spectrum of like opinions. And I feel like he won't play it safe. He will take risks all the time. And like, he's very self-deprecating. Like, I've spoken to him a few times now, and he is self-deprecating about how his movies are perceived. Maybe they are divisive, but like you say, we'd be so much worse off without him. There aren't many filmmakers who can get you into a cinema with just one sentence, like a very killer pitch. And he is one who delivers on that, like, on such a clip. He's doing this like every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible when you think, as well, especially we've had like obviously writers and actors write recently, we've had COVID, and he's still doing it. It's incredible longevity. I don't think we'll get another one like him for a while, to be honest with you.
I would agree. Well, thank you, Bradley. That is Trap, which is in cinemas now. Next up, we're heading to Pandora, but probably not the Pandora you're thinking of with this.
If the legends were true,
I'm the only one who can open the vault.
Feel free to applaud.
That is Borderlands, the much-delayed adaptation of the looter shooter video game series about a ragtag group of mercenaries searching for a fabled vault on the planet of Pandora. But unlike Avatar's bioluminescent paradise, this Pandora is full of trash, monsters, and Mad Max-esque psychos killing everything in sight. Curiously, this is directed by Eli Roth, who steps outside his horror comfort zone to helm a sci-fi action adventure. It also has a stacked cast, including a very game Cate Blanchett as Take No Prisoners bounty hunter Lilith, Kevin Hart as elite soldier Roland, Creed 2's Florian Munteanu as the masked muscle Krieg, Barbie's Ariana Greenblatt as fan favourite explosives expert Tiny Tina, Jamie Lee Curtis as scientist Tannis, and in voice only, Jack Black as wisecracking robot Claptrap. Before we review the film, we're going to hear from Ariana Greenblatt and Florian Munteanu, who spoke to senior entertainment writer Lauren Melici recently.
Were you both familiar with the franchise beforehand? And like, if so, did you play the game before signing on or to prep?
I wasn't, but I went to my brother for all the help and advice I could get, and he kind of filled me in on the Borderlands lore. And yeah, I got my own gaming setup when I play, so that's nice. Fun. What about you?
Yeah, well, I played the games. I was familiar with the games. Not the best gamer. I was never too talented with it, but I always tried my best because I thought gaming is cool, and I still think gaming is cool.
Gaming is cool.
Exactly. But yeah, I was familiar with the games. So once, you know, this landed on my table, and once I saw that, you know, they wanted to cast Krieg, I was like, I'm perfect for this role.
Ariana, I know you said that you based Tiny Tina off of Harley Quinn. Totally comes through, like, in the movie. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I read the sides, like, I just read them through, kind of cold read, and the first thing that came to mind was Margot Robbie's rendition of Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad, and I immediately kind of was just studying how she prepped for that, especially since, obviously, Harley Quinn is such a beloved character, and there's comic books and movies and so much material on her that I wanted to see how she prepped for something that already existed. So I kind of followed in her footsteps with that, and I kind of read everything and watched everything and played everything I could for Tina. And yeah, there's definitely little looks that Harley does and little smiles that she does that I definitely kind of got inspired by. And that's the first thing I told Margot when I met her. I was like, by the way, inspo.
What about you, Florian? Did you draw off many particular inspiration?
Well, the thing is, you know, that this role is so insane and, you know, so crazy. Like, he's a complete lunatic. Once you get to know him better and get to know more of his background story. So I was prepping more in terms of the fighting style, you know, than having an actual idol or something that I could look up to what he does, because I wanted to be my own self with this one, and I wanted to go in raw. But fighting wise, I tried to adapt as much as possible, because this one was very different from the things that I did so far. You know, his movements are everything but controlled. You know, it's complete insanity.
The games are super beloved and have like a really intense like fan base and fandom. Were you guys intimidated by that at all? Did you feel any pressure?
For some reason, I'm always thrown into the fandom. So I've dealt with like the Marvel and the Star Wars people, and I love them with my whole heart. So diving into this one, I was like, all right, I'm ready. But I understand, as a fan of so much myself, I get kind of the connection that they have to these characters and these kind of worlds that you might spend so much time in all the time. So yeah, I definitely went out of my way to kind of ask fans of the game myself before I went to go film and kind of ask what they really loved about it. But you know, it's also such a longer format of what they're used to. It's like they play the game and they see these kind of characters come and go, but you're sitting and you're watching them live in real time for so long. So it was kind of finding that balance between having humanity in these characters that are watchable for the people that have no idea what the game are, and then also have those nostalgic factors of the people who do know the game and love the game, and finding that kind of middle ground is important.
That was Ariana Greenblatt and Florian Munteanu speaking to Lauren Melici. James, do you want to set this one up for us?
As you said, it's kind of based on the video game series, which started back in 2009. Hugely popular series. I think, are we back to the bad old days of video game adaptations here? Well, after The Last of Us, you just want another Last of Us, or at least the quality of The Last of Us. And this just feels very messy. I mean, you use the word ragtag to describe that bunch of mercenaries, which of course they are. And it just seems to fit this film perfectly. It's just a messy, messy work, really. I thought Cate Blanchett, as you said, is really game. You know, she's got this remarkable sort of red hair. She's kind of fiery. She doesn't do many blockbusters either. So I kind of enjoyed her. You know, she's kind of one of those actresses that can just handle anything. And I think she handles this with aplomb. But we've possibly got the most annoying character I've ever seen in a film, with the exception, obviously, of Jar Jar Binks in the shape of Claptrap, the robot. My God, that character was annoying. So you've got the brilliant Blanchett on one side, then Jack Black voicing Claptrap on the other, and then these kind of crazy characters in between. It's just a bizarre mess. And the problem is, I didn't really care about any of these characters and the mission that they're on. There's a few twists involved. We have Edgar Ramirez as Atlas, who's kind of the villain of the piece, who's basically hired Blanchett's bounty hunter, Lilith, to search for his daughter, Tina, on the planet of Pandora. And that's kind of how it starts. Lilith doesn't want to accept the job. There was a kind of nice line when she's like, oh, yeah, I will accept that amount of money, or something of that equivalent. That was nice. But yeah, and then she gets to the planet, and I thought it was brilliantly realized, the planet. I thought the kind of it had that feel of, again, a bit like The Last of Us, where I felt immersed when I was watching The Last of Us. I thought, oh my God, they brilliantly realized the look and feel of that game. Mm-hmm. And similarly here, I thought the production designers and the VFX team did a fantastic job in realizing this kind of rocky outcrop that is Pandora. It's kind of, as you said in your intro, kind of trash and monsters, and that was kind of nicely done. But to a certain degree, it feels very derivative. I mean, you mentioned Mad Max-esque kind of psychos. You've got Mad Max, there's kind of Avatar nods there too, with obviously Pandora, a little bit of Star Wars floating in there. It feels rather derivative anyway. I guess you could blame, you know, the game itself maybe is derivative on some level of certain things. Yeah, I just felt as it progressed, I didn't really bond emotionally to any of these characters. But I don't know, how did you feel?
I broadly agree with you there. I mean, somewhat infamously, this film was shot in 2021, which is 3 years ago now, and underwent fairly extensive reshoots, which Eli Roth wasn't actually involved in. The reshoots were taken over by Tim Miller, the director of Deadpool, while Eli Roth was making Thanksgiving. It really is one of those films that you can tell has been like reworked and slightly tweaked, and there's a little bit of, I would imagine, test screening shaping going on, all that kind of stuff. The biggest thing that it felt derivative of to me was Guardians, which is just an undeniable influence here, because it's a sort of space-based, irreverent action-adventure starring sort of slightly anti-heroic type characters who were all very capable, coming up against a just largely faceless force of intergalactic semi-fascistic police. The world itself, like you say, was hit and miss for me, in the sense that there were a few shots where I was like, wow, that has been like incredibly well realized. From what I understand, they did build some fairly impressive sets for this thing, but then you do have just the fact that there is just some very ropey, like obvious green screen stuff in there. The most impressive set piece to me was actually one where they go into like a subterranean sewer, and they're just running around in like a kind of storage area for about 20 minutes, fighting off like waves and waves of these psychos. And I thought that was actually incredibly well staged, and just was very clearly like people actually doing things for real in this basement. So I did like that. But then when you just get to the whole inevitable CG mess finale, I was just sort of rolling my eyes a little bit and thinking, oh, did we really have to go here? Like, there wasn't a lot that I think it could have done to redeem itself in those final scenes by that point, but it was sort of the final nail in the coffin for me that, yeah, we're just gonna do this very familiar ending again, are we? It's a shame, because I do like the idea of Cate Blanchett in one of these films, and she does give it her all, really. I did find Lilith a very entertaining and engaging character. She's very much the anti-heroic character in the mold of a sort of Snake Plissken, who doesn't really want to be there but has a sort of conscience and a morality to her that will not allow her to just step away from things when she knows it's the right thing to do. So I like that. Claptrap, I agree, incredibly annoying, which is consistent with the games, at least. I think he is generally considered one of the more annoying characters in video game history as well. Jack Black tries his best to make him slightly more endearing, I think, but it just doesn't work. He's just far too irritating. I did quite enjoy Tiny Tina, who's played by Ariana Greenblatt, who you may recognize as the young woman who gives Barbie a dressing down in that film in the high school. I thought she was quite good, very chaotic, like quite a lot of Harley Quinn energy to her, I would say, just slightly on the wrong side of craziness. And Kevin Hart oddly just plays it completely straight as Roland, like not really wisecracking at all, which I found sort of refreshing, but I wasn't all that blown away by his character. He's just pretty much the capable soldier character. So yeah, overall, not great. I was intermittently entertained, but I felt like this could have been a lot better. And like you say, just feel like a slight regression to the days of average to bad video game adaptations, which is a shame when we've had this run of great video game adaptations like Arcane and The Last of Us, Fallout. Felt like we were on a good run there, but yeah, this has broken it slightly, unfortunately.
I suppose we could say that it was filmed 3 years ago, like you said, before all of these other things came out.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
In a way, it's not back to the bad old days. It just happens to have taken ages to come out. I do always like to see really quality actors paired up, and here you get to see Blanchett and Jamie Lee Curtis share the screen, not for very long, and Curtis is in somewhat of a thankless role. And frankly, the kind of emotional backstory that we get between the two of them didn't work for me at all. But you do get to see the two of them on screen. So that was a small little bonus, I thought. And I actually quite enjoyed Kevin Hart playing it straight. As you said, it was quite refreshing. In a way, that role could have been played by many different people, but it was nice to see him try something different. But yeah, there was too much. You know, as you said, when you get towards that CGI ending, you're just kind of in despair. There was quite a lot of sort of video game elements as well, which maybe fans of the game will enjoy. The fact they have to collect three keys. And you mentioned that subterranean sewer sequence where they're sort of leaping over various bits of crumbling grate that they're standing on. And you can kind of imagine yourself sort of mashing the buttons, kind of doing that. But that's not really enough to sustain a film, though, unfortunately. That is always the problem between video game and movie adaptations, is you don't want it to feel too much like you're playing a game while you're watching it, because it's a very different experience. But it's weird. You mentioned Thanksgiving. I thought that was such a great Eli Roth film. And it feels like that feels like much more of an Eli Roth movie than this one. This doesn't really feel... He feels like a director for hire on this one, it feels like.
Yeah, absolutely. It felt like his heart was really in Thanksgiving. That was a real passion project for him. Whereas this, yeah, I actually spoke to him for the magazine. He did say he was very passionate about the idea of directing a sort of big science fiction movie like this, like a sort of Flash Gordon type movie. He's always wanted to do it, basically. And he felt like this was sort of the right property for him to get on board with. But yeah, it ultimately just doesn't feel like he was really the right fit for it. And there's always that sort of question hanging over it now of what exactly did he direct and what exactly did Tim Miller direct? And is his voice actually in there? Or there's a sort of credited writer called Joe Crombie, who, as far as I can tell, just doesn't exist. So I guess that's a pseudonym for someone, which is very bizarre. Someone's obviously wanted to step away from their involvement in this film, which again doesn't bode well. So yeah, just a bit of an odd duck all round, in the sense that this is, you know, an adaptation of a really beloved game that I'm sure people are very excited to see brought to the big screen, but doesn't seem to have been done with the same sort of reverence and just respect for the source material that, for example, The Last of Us was, where you had people like the original game's creators involved, and it was all done very just respectfully and just a straight adaptation, essentially. Whereas this just, yeah, a return to, let's just take a few elements that are sort of familiar from the games, but sort of do our own thing with it, basically, which isn't really what people want from video game adaptations nowadays, it seems.
I mean, oddly, considering all of those things you just said about the change of director and so forth, it feels reasonably coherent as a film. It was, at least you could follow it. It wasn't, there wasn't sort of huge gaps or thing on sort of narrative switches you go, you know, where you're sort of scratching your head. They did at least make it with the reshoots coherent on some level, just not that exciting really in the end, or just too much of a mess. But
you know, yeah, you wonder if they sort of dulled the edges of a bit in that process. That is Borderlands, which is also in cinemas from today. Next up, we're joining a born again duo with this.
I got a once-in-a-lifetime score. You're the Marine?
Yeah.
You the ex-con?
Yeah, I did time, but you only gotta cast aspersions at me, guys.
I'm trying!
Good, stop talking.
No alcohol detected.
Been about a week. The mayor is gonna be holding a party on election night.
Let's go!
There's gonna be money there, like none of you bums ever seen.
That is The Instigators, which reunites the Bourne Identity director and star Doug Liman and Matt Damon for the first time in 22 years. But Damon's character Rory is no Jason Bourne. He's a down-on-his-luck former Marine who teams up with Casey Affleck's lovable miscreant Cobby to execute a heist for a local gangster played by Michael Stuhlbarg. But the heist doesn't go to plan, and Rory and Cobby must go on the run from hitmen and the police, with Rory's psychiatrist, played by Hong Chau, also along for the ride. Before we review the film, we're going to hear from the film stars Matt Damon, Casey Affleck, and Hong Chau. They recently spoke to James. James, how were they?
They were great. They were very, very chatty. I mean, you know when you're doing an interview and you know people are happy to be there, like they're happy to promote a film because they believe in the film. And, you know, Casey Affleck co-wrote the movie, you know, Damon's sort of behind it as a producer. You know, of course they want to support it, but you could really tell they all wanted to be there and they were all very happy in each other's company. And they've all worked together in different capacities in the past as well. So they're all old friends.
Well, with no further ado, here's Matt Damon, Casey Affleck and Hong Chau.
We gotta find those guys before the cops do.
And put them down before they can talk.
Everybody in New England is after us.
I gotta speak to you. I really need you right now, Doc.
I would be breaking the law.
What if I took you hostage? I mean, like, you know, with your permission.
What kind of conversation is this?
You're gonna love him.
Matt, I'm gonna start with you, actually. I remember when you worked with Doug before on the Bourne Identity movie, I remember you telling me that because of all the reshoots, you kind of thought your career was gonna implode a little bit. So this time around, it must have been a radically different experience, I'm assuming, working with Doug.
Yeah. Thankfully, we're both 20 years older and more experienced. The first time I worked with him, it was pretty fraught. And it was more that the word on the street in Hollywood was that it was a bomb because our release date got pushed and all this stuff. And so we all thought we were in trouble. But
did it open very well the first weekend?
It did. It opened at $27 million. Though the Scooby-Doo movie that weekend opened at 54.
That's what I saw that weekend.
but anyway, the experience of working with him, I love Doug and I love the way he works and I love his body of work. I mean, if you just can't argue with these movies are all wonderful. They're all very different and they're tonally all really unique. And that's what we needed with this one. So when I decided to join, you know, because Casey wrote the script with Chuck McLean, when I decided to jump on board and we started talking about directors, that I said, let me send it to Doug and see if he's interested. And that turned out to be a really good thought to cross my mind.
So Casey, what did inspire you writing this script with Chuck?
He started it. I wanted to do a comedy and he happened to have an idea and a script that was similar to what we ended up with and that I was going to work, I thought would work well, that I really wanted, with a part that I really wanted to play. Then I had to figure out how to make it something that other, you know, to have enough parts in there for other people to make it attractive to other people. But it was exactly the right tone. Chuck's got a great sense of humor. He's also from Boston. It was set here already. And I just liked it a lot. And he sort of was nice enough to say, just run with it. You know, he didn't really even want to be that involved. So I got to sort of take it apart and make it into something that more that I wanted to act in and to create parts for other people that were strong enough that they would want to come and play. I was just watching Downsizing a lot and I thought, man, just these two seem really good. And then once Doug got his hands on it, he just ripped it all apart and sort of put it back together anew.
I mean, Hong, your character, I guess, is almost like the voice of reason between Rory and Kobe. So is that how you saw her?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know about voice of reason because it's something that she does seems kind of unreasonable, which is hopping into a car and agreeing to be a hostage. That was actually something that Doug talked a lot about when I was first meeting with him for it. And he really wanted to emphasize the situation and the realness of the characters and to make that be what stood out about the movie. movie as opposed to all of the action. And I guess that's what I signed up for, was because it seemed like an opportunity to really act and to play a real character. And it sort of upended my idea of what an action movie is because of the way that Doug works. It was so, I guess, creatively chaotic and in terms of like being able to play with the scenes and not have to stick exactly to the script or do what was written for that day. And that really surprised me. So it was just like from start to finish, just a really interesting and creative experience for me.
I mean, this film's also got Ron Perlman, Alfred Molina, Michael Stuhlbarg, Paul Walter Hauser, Toby Jones. I mean, it's one of the best support casts I've seen in a long time. I don't know who can answer this, but how did that cast just come together?
Well, I can answer it. I mean, I think it's Doug Liman. I couldn't believe these actors that were responding to these roles because they're smaller roles. But I think that just speaks to everybody wanting to work with Doug, you know, and seeing something on the page that they really like. They go, you know, they look at it and go, okay, I know what to do with this. I can do something fun with that. And
every one of them made their part better.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
I mean, maybe Casey can take this one, but obviously there's a whole political subtext to the film with the mayor, Ron's character, not conceding the election. That has a little bit of a Trump overtone, it feels like. So was there a little bit of a dig going on there?
There's stuff in the script that will smack of something from real life, whether it's like a corrupt mayor in Boston or someone sitting in office who doesn't want to give up the seat. But you got to find humor somewhere, and maybe the best place to look is real life and how closely it comes to, you know, anyone or real person. You got to ask Doug.
As you mentioned, Matt and Hong worked on Downsizing. Matt and Casey, you worked on Jerry together like almost 20 odd years ago. So did it feel just like a sort of coming together of old friends in a certain way?
I love this job so much. And the only thing better than doing it is doing it with people that I care about and really admire. And so any chance I get to do that, I'll do it. But it is nice to be in scenes with people that you've had good working experiences with and you trust. Especially when you're going to kind of be improvising stuff or taking chances on scenes, or let's try one this way. You there's just a level of it's kind of an adventurous vibe that you get when you're not kind of walled off, when you're kind of open to, all right, let's try it this way. Let's see what happens. And Doug's really good at creating that kind of environment, but it really helps when your scene partner is somebody that you know.
You're producing, of course, with Ben as well, your old friend. So how involved was he? And obviously, I have to ask the question, who is the cooler Affleck brother?
Ooh.
The cooler Affleck brother. I don't know that any of us are cool. If you ask any of our kids, you would get laughed off the road.
Hong said the set had a very dad feel, very strong dad energy going on, which sounded like a put down. I don't know why.
That's a compliment.
Yeah, maybe Zaddy energy.
Yeah, how involved was Ben, though, in terms of the sort of day-to-day producing aspect?
Well, very. I mean, you know, he was in L.A. running our office, but you know, in pre-production, you know, he was reading every draft of the script. I was in constant contact with him about that. And then, you know, throughout production, you know, we had a really smooth shoot. We had a really, you know, we were responsible for the overages, Doug and me and Artist Equity. So we came with a pretty good battle plan and we finished right on schedule. So there wasn't much producing for him to do in that regard. We had Kevin Walsh there as well. So, and Allison Winter and my wife. And so it was like, we were covered. So his day-to-day producing during the shoot, you know, there wasn't too much for him to do except the odd phone call. But then in post, he came back and watched cuts and gave notes and did all the things a producer does.
That was Matt Damon, Casey Affleck and Hong Chau. James, do you want to set this one up for us?
This is kind of like an old school crime yarn, caper movie on some level. As you mentioned in your intro, Matt Damon plays Rory, an ex-Marine who's in sort of dire financial straits, which is why he decides to team up on this heist, which is being run, as you said, by Michael Stuhlbarg, who's a kind of local gangster, and also Alfred Molina, who's kind of his sidekick, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. Amongst those on the heist is Casey Affleck's character, Cobby. It's been taking place during the kind of local Boston mayoral elections. Ron Perlman plays the mayor. He's brilliant in it, I have to say. And it goes disastrously wrong. And I won't say why, because that's too much of a spoiler just to find out what happens. But basically, Rory and Cobby are kind of on the run. They're trying to figure their way out of this complete mess. You've got sort of special unit cops, one played by Ving Rhames, coming after them. You've got kind of thuggish kind of hitmen type characters, one played by Paul Walter Hauser, coming after them. They're being hit at from all angles, basically. And then somehow or other, they grab Hong Chau's character, who is a sort of a therapist that's been working with Rory, to almost to help them survive, basically, this complete mess. It's funny and it's dark and it's twisted, and there's just a lot going on in this film. As you mentioned, it's Doug Liman, who did, you know, The Bourne Identity with Matt Damon many, many years ago. More recently, American Made. And it just feels like everyone's on the same page with this movie. Do you know what I mean? It's just really works. Yeah, it's got a fantastic support cast. Toby Jones pops up in it. Yeah, it's just one of those you think, God, that's incredibly well cast. It's just, it felt like, I don't want to keep, everyone says, oh, they always compare them to movies in the 70s. This to me had that feel, or even an indie from the 90s or something.
Yeah, and definitely.
Just, you know, some great action sequences in it. There's a sort of car chase cut to Petula Clark's downtown, which is very nicely done. There's a kind of riot sequence, which I guess in this country has taken on something of a significance over the last couple of weeks. But there's a riot sequence set to the House of Pain's Jump Around, which is very, very well done. So there's kind of humor. There's kind of humor, but there's a lot of action. But it's very character driven beyond anything else. That's what I really liked about it. You know, in the end, Damon's character, he's got a very specific reason why he needs, it's just over $32,000, $33,480, I think is the exact figure, if I'm remembering this correctly. And he very specifically needs that amount of money, which you find out why later on. And you kind of really buy into what his reason is for taking this heist on, because he's not a sort of career criminal. And yeah, so there's kind of an emotional layer as well that really works. And it's kind of, I suppose in the end, you'd call it a kind of buddy-buddy story between him and Kobe. And they get on, they work really well. I mean, Affleck and Damon go way back in terms of acting. They were in Jerry, the Gus Van Sant movie. That was like 22 years ago, I think. And of course, they've known each other forever as friends, you know, growing up in the Boston scene. Mm-hmm. And you can just tell, again, that sort of chemistry, that friendship just comes through, and it really, really plays well in this film. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I completely agree with you on all that. I found this really good fun. I really enjoyed two elements of it, which is it has the, as you say, the sort of Midnight Run sort of odd, slightly odd couple quality, where Cobby and Rory are slightly chalk and cheese, but they're very entertaining when they are together, constantly bickering. Cobby is a slightly abrasive character in the sense that he's very motor mouth, very, very sort of self-confident. He's a sort of former con who is doing this job because he wants the money, but he is inadvertently very capable. But then there's also the fact that it's sort of an anti-Ocean's 11 in the sense that it's a heist movie where just everything goes wrong, basically. The initial heist is a complete disaster. They go on the run. That goes completely wrong. They're chased. They barely escape every single time. So it's quite refreshing to see that coming from Doug Liman and Matt Damon as well, because, of course, Jason Bourne, basically the most capable person in the history of cinema, can get out of any scrape you can imagine. And Rory is very much not that. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's like taking notes when he's in the middle of a heist to make sure he doesn't forget what to do, or all these kind of things. So all that's very fun. All that's very self-conscious, I think. I think Damon very consciously wanted to play a character as far away from Jason Bourne as possible, which is a little unusual for him on screen because we're used to seeing him play these very capable characters. And yeah, Doug Liman is a director who I really like. And when he's sort of firing on all cylinders, he does just make really solidly entertaining films. Even though it wasn't universally beloved, I did really enjoy his remake of Roadhouse from earlier this year as well. And this is just a very solidly entertaining film, which I just don't think you're going to be disappointed by if you stick it on a Friday night. And like you say, really remarkable supporting cast, actually. I very much enjoyed seeing Ving Rhames back as well in a bit more of a substantial role than we're used to seeing him, especially in the Mission Impossible films, where he basically has glorified cameos every 3 to 4 years in those films. But this is a proper role, and he's basically this super cop who drives around in a tank, which I found quite amusing, like a sort of one-man police force, basically, which is pretty good. And Hong Chau is terrific as well. It's just quite an interesting element to have a psychiatrist along for the ride, because Rory is constantly being therapized by his psychiatrist, basically, and they sort of talking about their feelings and what they're thinking as they're going through everything. And yeah, all that stuff was just really well considered, felt quite different, and was just always on the right side of entertaining. Like, it never dragged. And also a surprisingly sort of political film as well. There are certainly parallels you can draw with certain politicians.
Certain politicians who won't concede or didn't concede a certain election. Yes, exactly. That does play into the Ron Perlman character. But no, you're right. It does have that layer. There's just a lot of different layers to this film, which I really, really like. Yeah, and you're right. Doug Liman just can be very, very solidly entertaining when he gets it right. And but again, I think it's that Damon and Hong Chow worked together on Downsizing, the Alexander Payne film. As I mentioned, Damon and Affleck have got a long history as well. And this is also co-produced by Ben Affleck as well with Matt Damon. So there's just that feeling that they all know each other. They're all on the same, but not in that kind of way of, you know, a bunch of mates getting together and then it's all a bit, you know, icky. This is like they all wanted to make something really, really good. And it feels like that's come off. And that doesn't always happen, you know, especially when it's people that all know each other. But I really felt like they all were going in the same direction on this film. They all knew what they wanted to make. And it's really paid off, I think.
Well, that was The Instigators, which is out in select cinemas now, but the place you'll probably want to watch it is on Apple TV+. Next up, it's an adaptation of a best-selling romance novel. It's this.
We all have an idea of what love can be.
I want to see you again.
Now you see me.
You know what I mean.
That special connection you feel. That first kiss. But 15 seconds, that's all it takes to completely change everything.
That is It Ends With Us, or to give it its full title, Colleen Hoover's It Ends With Us. Now, I'm actually the only one who's seen this, so I'll talk at you, James, if that's okay.
You do that.
So like I say, it's an adaptation of a mega-selling romance novel starring Blake Lively as Lily Blossom Bloom, to give her a full name. And yes, there is a joke about that in the film. She wants to set up a flower store, incredibly, just obsessed with flowers, in Boston. And it's during this period of her life that she meets a character called Ryle, played by Justin Baldoni, who is actually also the film's director, incredibly. They strike up a very heated relationship, very passionate. They quickly fall in love. As this is happening, we flash back to Lily's childhood when she was in a relationship with a young man called Atlas, who at the time was temporarily unhoused. And Lily, in an act of kindness, gives Atlas some food and a sleeping bed. He's sort of squatting in the empty house across the street from her. And they sort of start a relationship despite the fact that he's being bullied at school because of this fact. This is obviously a very formative experience in her life, because at the same time, we learn that Lily's father is abusing her mother. And the reason that Atlas has left his own home is because of domestic abuse. So there's this element of domestic abuse that runs through it. And then back in the present day, Lily and Ryle's relationship seems to be going great until one day, as they say in the trailer, 15 seconds changes everything. And in a moment, Lily realizes that this sort of cycle of abuse is continuing with her and Ryle. And at the same time, it turns out that Atlas is also in Boston, which causes those two characters to sort of rekindle their relationship. So the interesting thing about this film is that on the surface, it is just a very sort of glossy romantic drama, in the sense that, you know, it's very attractive people in very aspirational circumstances where they live in these just impossibly expensive penthouses, wearing Valentino clothes, all just very aspirational stuff. But then there is just this very dark, dramatic undercurrent to it all, where it is essentially about cycles of domestic abuse and escaping cycles of domestic abuse, and how that can come from nowhere, and how can you can find yourself in these circumstances despite the fact you obviously haven't been looking to get in any kind of relationship like this. Blake Lively is very engaging in the lead. She has to have a certain element of sort of melancholy and sadness to her, because she does have this element in her past, and I thought she played that very well. You do have the sort of competing love interest elements, in the sense that you have the Atlas and the Ryle character. The Ryle character is, again, just totally aspirational stuff. The sort of a sequence where he rips his shirt off and obviously he's got the shredded abs and all that kind of stuff. And he's, again, they make jokes about this, but he's like a neurosurgeon who, like, you know, is incredibly wealthy, lives in this beautiful apartment, sort of the ideal life. But the whole idea is that it's just undercut by the fact that staying with him is just not in any way ideal for Lily and would destroy her life. And then you have the Atlas character who's this beacon of hope in the middle of it all. So I would say I was sort of surprised by how deeply moving a lot of this was, to be honest. Like, I expected it to go in expecting it to be a sort of, you know, slightly glossier Hallmark movie, essentially, because that's what you expect from a lot of modern romantic dramas. But actually, I thought there was some sort of real depth to this, and it did try to say something about what it is like to be in a situation of domestic abuse and what it means to escape that situation. And it doesn't always give easy answers to those questions. There's some very complicated sort of a knotty family dynamics to it all, which I was impressed by. And then to give it its due, it does have some very funny sort of comic relief elements in it as well, because Jenny Slate's in it as the sort of best friend character to Lily, who is also the brother of Ryle, which sort of plays into those slightly complicated family dynamics I was talking about. But she's just a very funny presence in the film, and she really enlivens it and makes sure it never gets a bit too saccharine or somber or anything. And then you also have Hasan Minhaj in there as the sort of boyfriend character, the husband character to Jenny Slate's character. So yeah, I was actually solidly impressed by this film, actually.
I'll be honest, I was not expecting you to say this, actually. Yeah. That you were, you know, as you say, it looked from the outside very much like a Hallmark movie. Ryle is played by Justin Baldoni, who directed it as well. So
correct, yeah.
How did he work as a director, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's in a substantial amount of the film. It's really he is the main romantic lead for well over half of the film. So, I mean, all I can imagine is that it was just an extraordinary amount of work for him. And, you know, he directs himself. He's meant to be the idealized romantic lead. So the lens looks upon him lovingly, which I'm sure wasn't all that hard for him to do as a director to make himself look good, you know. I think it helps the fact that he sort of steps away a little bit sort of halfway through as the film does take this turn, which would allow him to focus on the equally time-consuming job of actually directing this film. But yeah, I had seen his a couple of his previous films, Clouds and 5 Feet Apart, which are actually both sort of cancer dramas, which, you know, deal with heavy subject matter, and this similarly deals with heavy subject matter. And I think he does do it with a certain amount of sensitivity. And, you know, it's not like, it's not a kitchen sink drama. It's not like Tyrannosaur, you know, like it's not like a super serious take on this subject matter. It is ultimately like a fairly glossy romantic drama. And all this stuff is very, you know, idealized and not at all sort of realistic or relatable to most people. But the fact that it does even sort of broach this subject matter and does it with a certain amount of sensitivity, I was pleasantly impressed by. So I would say,
you're saying you're not a neurosurgeon with shredded abs then?
Not yet, obviously. No. You know, no. There's still time. I could go and get my doctorate. I could still hit the gym, but not yet, unfortunately. But Ryle, yeah, I mean, good on him, like, fair play. But unfortunately, he needs to work on his anger issues. So yeah, that is It Ends With Us, which is also in cinemas from today. Now, because it's a genuinely bumper week, 13 new releases by my count, we're going to very quickly run through a few more films hitting cinemas today. First, there's Babes, which is a bridesmaids-esque best friends comedy starring Ilana Glazer and Michelle Buteau. They are the kind of lifelong BFFs where there are no boundaries. Buteau's Dawn is married and has just given birth to her second child. Glazer's Eden runs a yoga studio from her apartment and has yet to settle down. One day, Eden meets Stephen James as Claude and in short order becomes pregnant. But when Eden finds that Claude is no longer in the picture for reasons I won't spoil, she decides to become a single mom, which puts her sisterhood with Dawn under intense strain. And yeah, I had very mixed feelings on this one, in the sense that I didn't actually find it as funny as I was hoping. Eden in particular is a very abrasive character. The sense of arrested development with her is very annoying. They're the kind of characters that just sort of scream at each other constantly. Genuinely quite irritated me. But on the other hand, it is actually a very authentic and honest sort of pregnancy movie, in the sense that it doesn't sort of shy away from the sides that often aren't portrayed on screen. Certainly not in a film like It Ends With Us, which does sort of feature a pregnancy and birth, but is, you know, as with the rest of that film, very idealized and glamorized. Whereas with this, You hear about all the bodily fluids. You go through the whole process of all the doctor's appointments. It doesn't shy away from the fact that having and raising children is just a kind of soul-crushing thing where it just takes over your whole life and does completely jeopardize and harm your friendships with people, even with people that you have been best friends with for your whole life, because your priority once you have children just has to be your children and it can't be, you know, maintaining friendships like this. So I did like the fact that it dealt with those aspects. But yeah, for me, the hit rate of the comedy just wasn't quite high enough. I just wasn't 100% on its wavelength, unfortunately. I've never seen Broad City, which I know is the kind of sitcom that Ilana Glazer made her name with. So I imagine if you're an Ilana Glazer fan, this might be more on your wavelength. But the comedy didn't connect with me, but the sort of deeper things actually did. So bit of a mixed recommendation there for that one. Then there's Sky Peels, a British indie, which debuted at last year's Venice Film Festival and is finally hitting UK cinemas today. James, you've seen this one. What's this one about?
So this is written and directed by Moin Hussein, and it's quite unusual. It's a British-Asian sci-fi, which, let's face it, there aren't many of those around. And it stars Faraz Ayoub, who plays a character called Adam, who's a sort of lonely figure who works in kind of in a motorway service station restaurant at night. He does the night shift. You know, that's a pretty bleak job to sort of have to sort of exist through. He's also estranged from his father, who quite near the beginning of the film, his father dies and he has to sort of reconnect with his family, you know, as he sort of goes to the funeral. But then he sort of begins to believe through various things he discovers about his father that his father might be an alien. And then he starts to wonder if indeed he is also an alien. Strange things happen, like car alarms and things start going off as he walks past them. Just little oddities like that. It's a very, very strange film. And as I said, it's quite interesting that it's a British Asian sci-fi. We've not really had many of those at all. The director has a real vision, which I think he really pursues. It's a little bit of a slow burn. Anyone that's interested in sci-fi, especially British sci-fi, I mean, I suppose the closest we'd come is something like Under the Skin. I mean, obviously that's, you know, Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin is a complete masterpiece. This film doesn't come close to that. But there aren't many of them set in the UK. And it really captures the sort of concrete jungle bleakness of these kind of motorway service stations as well. He really used that location very, very well. And again, even any dramas set around that kind of a setting, I've not really seen particularly. I mean, there aren't many of them. I mean, we don't really have many road movies in this country because we don't really have the geography for it. And although I wouldn't class this as a road movie, there's lots of roads in it. There's lots of transport and travel, if that makes any sense, just the sort of background setting. But yeah, it's, you know, it's really a film about identity and community on some level, and the character of Adam does sort of navigate his way through this very strange landscape as he starts to question what he might be and where he might have come from. I suppose you could say there's a small amount of Close Encounters of the Third Kind in there on a very, very small level. Yeah, it's an unusual and an interesting film. I definitely think it's worth your time.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll definitely be checking that one out. Finally, the ultimate cut of Tinto Brass's controversial historical drama Caligula also hit cinemas today. The film's 1979 release, which starred the likes of Malcolm McDowell, Helen Mirren, Peter O'Toole, and John Gielgud, was famously hijacked in post-production by Bob Guccione, the film's financier and founder of men's magazine Penthouse, who inserted, no pun intended, actual hardcore sex scenes into the film. I mean, could you imagine that happening today? That would just be headline news everywhere. Completely unreal. But this ultimate cut strips all those out and restores the original film to a state that much more closely resembles the original vision. Is that right, James?
Yeah, that's spot on. I think even then it was headline news. I mean, it was still pretty shocking. I mean, I know Malcolm McDowell, who I spoke to for a feature for Total Film on this recut, he was absolutely betrayed by this, you know, to see this version. I mean, Gore Vidal, who wrote the original script, and Tinto Brass didn't exactly see eye to eye, but they at least were aiming to get their vision across. But yeah, when Guccione got involved, yeah, it became something else. It just became a notorious mess, basically. Mm-hmm. So now, basically what happened is the Penthouse archives had loads of original footage that was shot but never used for Caligula. So they've gone back to try and restore something as close to the original vision. It's now running almost 3 hours. It looks incredible. I mean, one thing Guccione did do, which I suppose he deserves credit for, is hire production designer Danilo Donati, who, this is the second mention of Flash Gordon in the in the pod today. Donati went on to do the Flash Gordon sets, and if you remember those being quite sort of lavish and spectacular and well, obviously sci-fi-esque in that capacity. That's what he's doing here with the Caligula sets as well. And they look incredible on the big screen. So that is one reason alone to go and see this film again on the big screen. But, you know, here you're getting McDowell's performance as it was intended as Caligula. You're seeing much more Helen Mirren than you did in the original version. There's probably about another 40-odd minutes of Mirren in there. Wow. She plays Caligula's wife. Yeah, it's much more nearer, you know, what Vidal and Brass intended. But, you know, it's still got some quite extreme and explicit scenes in it as well, scenes that were there, but they've taken out all of the, well, the penthouse pets, as they were, that were the the girls that Guccione sort of, you know, commandeered to film all these kind of pornographic scenes. That's all gone, of course. But, yeah, it's definitely, I mean, for sort of anyone who's just kind of film historian, this is definitely worth seeing, because it's very unusual to have a film so notorious to now have that original vision put back. You know, it's a real, you know, I suppose you'd call it as close as you can to a director's cut, even though Brass himself wasn't involved. Brass is now 91, basically, so he's still alive, but he wasn't involved in this restoration, let's call it. But right. I think he would hopefully be pleased as to that it's something akin to what he'd intended.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And yeah, great for film preservation. Believe it or not, there are even more films out this week that we sadly don't have time to review, including Tuesday, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Neil Marshall's Duchess, which is a Brit crime thriller in the Guy Ritchie mold, a re-release of Spider-Man 2, perhaps the best Spider-Man movie. Would you agree, James?
That is a good question. I was just thinking that. well, it does have the mighty Alfred Molina as Doc Ock, isn't it? So yeah, I think I'd probably go with that. It's got to be better than Spider-Man 3, hasn't it?
Yeah, can't argue with that. No, perhaps about it for me. Definitely the best Spider-Man movie. There's also kids animation Gracie and Pedro, Mission Impossible, which our reviewer gave 3 stars and said, not too much of a chore for grown-ups, which is damning with faint praise if ever I heard it. And finally, it wouldn't be an episode of the Inside Total Film podcast without a mention of Bluey. And the Heeler family hit the cinema this week with Bluey at the Cinema Family Trip Collection, which is actually 8 back-to-back episodes loosely themed around Heeler family trips, and includes one of my personal favorite episodes entitled Obstacle Course, which features maybe the single funniest moment in the whole show for me. I'll just say Mongoose and leave it at that for all you Bluey fans. So yeah, if you've ever wanted to see Bluey on the big screen, now's your chance. So an absolute treasure trove of releases there, James. But what is your film of the week?
Well, easily The Instigators, I think. Although a little shout out to Caligula, just because I really enjoyed what they did with that. But from a brand new film point of view, then definitely The Instigators.
Yeah, obviously we can't speak to Trap, having not seen it. But yeah, it's sort of neck and neck between The Instigators and It Ends With Us for me, which as previously described, I was very pleasantly surprised by it. And The Instigators is just, yeah, really good fun. Maybe It Ends With Us is your cinema trip and The Instigators is your Saturday night in front of the TV watch, because of course that is on Apple TV Plus as well. At long last, we're approaching the end of the podcast now, and just a quick reminder that our Alien Romulus issue is still on sale for just under one more week, so you can find it in shops or pick it up digitally before our very exciting new issue hits shelves next Thursday. And if you take out a subscription, you now get instant digital access to the Alien Romulus issue, so you can start reading it immediately before your first print copy arrives. So if you don't subscribe already, please do consider joining us. If you fancy signing up, you can find a subscription link in the podcast notes. Talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your podcast app of choice. We'd really appreciate it. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email via totalfilm@futurenet.com. We always like to hear from you. And before we go, time for a quick question in honor of M. Night's latest release. What is your favorite film twist, James?
I am going to go for... This is terrible if anyone, by the way, has not seen this film, but hopefully
We should say massive spoiler alert for these films. First and then skip ahead 30 seconds
exactly.
If you haven't seen it.
I'm going with The Usual Suspects. So if you haven't seen The Usual Suspects, put your fingers in your ears or something. But the revelation that Kevin Spacey's character, Verbal Kint, is in fact master criminal Kaiser Sose. The whole sequence on the bulletin board, when the camera pans across the bulletin board and you realize he's just been making up this shaggy dog story for the last hour and a half. I thought that was a fantastic twist. In fact, I remember someone, when I saw the film, someone had already seen it and did warn me that there was some sort of twist, which was a bit annoying because I would have obviously not liked that in my brain, but I still thought it was an incredible twist. So there you go. What was yours?
Yeah, I'm not just doing this because of the M. Night connection, but the Sixth Sense, again, skip ahead 30 seconds if you're the last remaining person on the planet who doesn't know the twist in the Sixth Sense. But yeah, absolutely remarkable twist. Bruce Willis was dead all along. The thing that works really well about that twist is that you can rewatch that film knowing that twist and have almost a completely different experience that's basically just as satisfying as watching it the first time and that twist hitting like a ton of bricks. It just works so beautifully well. The Sixth Sense is really Knight just at the top of his game. It's such a well-considered film. And even though he did garner a bit of a reputation as the twist guy, and some of his later twists perhaps aren't as effective as the twist in The Sixth Sense, but The Sixth Sense is just one of the all-timers, and you can't really say a bad word about it as far as I'm concerned. And really just became synonymous with movie twists, basically, didn't it? If you knew The Sixth Sense, if you were going to mention it, you would mention the twist in the same breath. That's how intertwined it all was. So you can't say fairer than that.
Good choice. It is, as you say, it was just that moment in cinema, wasn't it, when everyone was like, oh my god, what an incredible twist. And the certain catchphrase, I'm not sure if we should say the catchphrase in case it's too much of a spoiler, but I see dead people did kind of enter into the cultural lexicon, really. I mean, that became an incredible piece of movie dialogue.
Yeah.
There you go.
I do wonder if a twist like that could ever hit in the same way nowadays, because things are just spoiled on social media, like 3 minutes after the film's premiere. So how could you ever keep a twist like that contained? I just don't think you ever could anymore. I remember back in the day, people would just speak about The Sixth Sense in like hushed whispers, like no one wanted to ruin the experience for other people, which seems to be the opposite of what's happening nowadays, where, you know, even actual filmmakers, directors, stars are posting like pirated clips of their films on social media. Like, well, it would obviously never happened in 1999 because social media didn't exist. But yeah, today I just don't think you could release a movie like The Sixth Sense and it have the same impact, because everyone would probably know the twist going in.
Well, you need to start one of those viral campaigns of, you know, shush, don't spoil the secret. And then anyone who does is obviously immediately lambasted on social media. So, and no one wants to be lambasted on social media. That would be a terrible thing.
Fate worse than death nowadays. Right. Well, that's all from us for now. Next week, Matt and I will be back to talk Alien Romulus and more. So thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.